Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Now, I told you I'd introduce you to our esteemed business panel. They're here in the shape of Kathleen Gallagher. She's the markets correspondent with the Business Post. And also, Lorcan Allen of Keating & Associates, former Business Postman. So it's all going to be Business Post today. And we start, would you guess what, with a market story. Kathleen, no one moves markets like Trump. Good news if you're on the right side of the trade. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think the volatility in markets caused by Trump, that's no surprise to anyone. It's been happening since the beginning of his second term. But what was interesting this week is obviously we had quite dramatic moves in oil based on the developments of the market of the conflict in Iran. And there was a sharp reversal based on Trump's comments that there were talks. And the Financial Times found that traders were on the right side of that trade leading up to that announcement. And so it caused a bit of skepticism in terms of, are they just really, you know, well-timed bets that there's going to be a reversal, or is someone leaking something? And is there some kind of like financial play going on there?
Is there a suggestion that, you know, the markets are always guided by political activity, things like oil prices, and, you know, they always reflect the sentiment of investors. Is there a sense that Trump, because he's so erratic, you know, that he makes the markets, and he's also, you know, while you may not agree with him, he's also quite smart in that he knows that if he says something about, you know, the war being shorter than we all thought, he if anybody's close to the markets, it's him.
Yeah, absolutely. And he views the markets as very important. Like, as a president, we know that he's watching and he is very driven by what's happening there. And analysts, you know, they're kind of saying at the moment, you don't have to take him at his word. It's more of a guide in terms of where his head's at. And him saying that there's like progressive talks, that's him indicating that he wants out of the war. And that's enough to help them, even if we're not sure how far along or if those talks are happening.
Yeah. Lorcan?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the commentary is that how unpredictable Trump is and he can do anything. I mean, Donald O'Donovan has a really good analysis piece there where he talks about Donald Trump's ability to move markets is unprecedented. And it really is. I mean, we see the volatility he causes. And, you know, his comments over last weekend where he talked about the war, oil prices shot up. But what was actually quite predictable was that he would say something then on the Monday to try and calm the markets, because like oil prices are fundamental to the US economy and US consumers. Donald has a really good line in it I like, where he says, you know, almost a year ago I wrote that US President Donald Trump was starting to lose his ability to shock investors. And that's obviously not proved. He kind of goes, that comes back, you know, he continues to find ways to shock markets, whether it was the trade tariffs this time last year, his Liberation Day, and now it's this. You know, he's having a big impact on financial markets.
While I have you there, what about Joe Summerlad's piece in the Irish Independent? His support has plunged to a new low, like 59% of the American population believe that Mr. Trump was wrong to use military force in Iran, and 45% believe the war isn't going well. They're two very damaging stats.
They are. And what's even like, that's a survey conducted by Fox News, like, which would be as supportive as well.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, even his own supporters are disapproving of the war, particularly as Trump made a lot of rhetoric and noise about that he was going to get the US out of these wars that he's, you know, Biden and Obama had started in his view. And now he's creating his own conflicts that are entirely new. I mean, I'm not surprised that support is down for him, because like, I was in the US before Christmas, and one thing I always do is I like to go into a supermarket and see what the prices of things are, because that says a lot. The price of food in America is insane.
I know.
Like, it's like, I remember it was two steaks in a packet was $45.
Yeah.
A packet of mince was $25. Like, insane prices. So, like, US consumers aren't really preoccupied, or, you know, do they care about Iran? Probably not deeply. But what they do care about is the price of food. And okay, food or price of their everyday living. Price of food has gone up a lot, obviously. But when oil prices are going up like they are now, and they're, you know, filling a tank of gas is very important to the US consumer, and that's starting to cost them. That's when the support will flow away from
them. And Kathleen, we're looking at gas prices, as they call them, up now. $1 a gallon. Significant in US terms. They're, and just to put it in context, their petrol or gas is about a third of the price that we pay here. But, you know, Americans that I know will be guided by the price of a gallon of petrol in the forecourt, much more, as Larkin says, than overseas wars or that. In other words, and this will really come back to bite Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as Larkin was pointing out, the kind of, there is a cost of living, like crisis is probably too strong, but it is very expensive in the US and everyone is feeling it. And the price of gas is just going to make that worse. And it comes back to that point that Trump had promised to kind of make America great again, make it better for the everyday man. And it's not happening. And you can see that reflected in his approval ratings. And we're getting to the midterms. So this is why this is so relevant. And this is why he is so adamant that the war will not be prolonged, because he needs to get some kind of resolution in place before we hit those midterms, because they're critical for him.
So if he isn't, you know, if he doesn't bring about the end to this war in whatever way, you know, that might manifest itself, he's going to be in trouble in terms of the midterms.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, he was probably already in trouble on the midterms anyway, but he needs to show some sort of positive momentum on the
economy. Larkin, what about staying with that war and maybe moving closer to home? Jack Horgan-Jones has an interesting piece in the Times about, you know, the war in Iran sabotaging our own government's budgetary plans. And again, we saw some of the emergency measures now coming into play on fuel. These are very, very costly. And if this war runs on, it could put a big hole in the budget plans in October.
Yeah, it's an excellent piece by Jack Horgan-Jones. I mean, COVID triggered an increase in government spending, you know, in reaction to the crisis situation that was. And, you know, those were measures that had to be taken. What, like, when you stand back and look at government spending over the last 6 years, what's interesting is the increase that happened during COVID, that was never unwound. The government budget is like, it went up 40%, I think, in 1 year to match COVID. They never actually kind of cut back their spending when COVID eased. It was always the next crisis. Then there was Ukraine. And then last year was the first time it was like, okay, things are normal. And there was a more subdued budget, but they didn't there was no cutting back of spending. And as Jack Horgan-Jones points out, like, you know, he says how Department of Public Expenditure is allergic to every department getting cost of living packages, money to be sluiced out through reductions in things such as exam fees or public transport fees, because withdrawing these measures then becomes a political battleground after the fact. So we put in these sort of cost of living or emergency supports, but then we can't unwind them because it becomes a political problem. And that's the challenge the government faces now, is that as it goes to try and react to this current situation, well, we've already increased our spending so much, we don't have as much wiggle room to do it again.
And Pat Lee also writing about the same subject, Kathleen. The budget surplus won't last long in this climate. And he's basically, you know, it's almost an extension of what Jack Horgan-Jones is saying. But, you know, we're going to be spending a lot of money here very quickly, and it is going to affect what happens in October.
Yeah, I mean, I think the two pieces kind of are a continuation, as you say, because what Pat Lee, he's kind of pointing out is to Lorcan's point, we are seeing like crisis after crisis, like it's a very volatile geopolitical climate out there. And we are continually seeing the impact. And the government's rush to respond to all that is impacting their budget. The central bank had a report out this week looking at what the government did in the last fiscal crisis. And it said that the government could have saved $2 billion by having more targeted, tailored, temporary measures. And then they said, looking at the current measures, that there's a risk that, again, it will overspend and not end up actually having as much of an impact, just because they're trying to appease the public.
Yeah. David McWilliams has a lovely way of intertwining, you know, life's lessons with economics. And he talks about a boxing contest in Zaire that he remembers as a child. And then he leads us into global recessions always happening after the price of oil increases. It's a kind of a nice wander through economic history of the last 50 years.
Yeah, it's a great piece by David.
Yeah.
David is always he's a great storyteller, and he makes economics tangible, I think, for your average person. Like, he talks about how, the rumble in the jungle, George Foreman and Muhammad Ali, that was fought in Zaire. But why was it fought in Zaire? Well, it was because, you know, there was an oil crisis, the price of oil had soared, and Zaire was a country that had lots of oil. And they were cash rich at the time, and the leader decided that, well, I'm gonna put out the money to have this boxing match here. And it leads him into talking about those kind of crises from 1970s and 80s and in the oil markets. Interestingly, in 1974, the global price of oil was $2.90 a barrel.
Yeah.
And it shot up to $11, $13 a barrel because of the crisis, compared to what we're at, $130 a barrel now today.
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
It's an incredible increase. But it's good piece looking back at it. And he's kind of claim at the end, or his point at the end, is like, you know, when oil crisis happen like this, that we should see that we should expect a recession. I don't necessarily agree with him on that point. I mean, I'm not an economist, but I mean, there's a lot of differences in the world economy compared to back then. One big difference today is the US is self-sufficient in oil.
Yeah.
And a lot of those things at the time were triggered where the US had to import quite a lot of oil. Today,
this was also before North Sea oil.
Exactly. But shale oil in the US.
Yeah.
The US is for the first time actually exporting oil to the world, rather than back then it was very heavily reliant on importing oil. The other thing as well, a lot of those Arab states, despite the war in Iran, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, they're all key allies of the US now. So they will keep like the floodgates opened up for oil prices. So, I mean, you know, we're going through a lot of volatility at the minute, but I don't see the same level of us versus them that back then that might trigger a prolonged economic crisis.
Kathleen, he also reminds us that in 1972, inflation jumped from 8.6% to 21%. Like, you know, when you think of those numbers and the effect that has on consumer spending and borrowing and all those things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like almost unimaginable for us to kind of imagine a 21% inflation. I mean, at the moment, we're talking about going from around 2% to around 4% in the worst scenario. That's what the central banks are predicting. So these are very extreme numbers that I can't comprehend.
You're too young to remember them. That's your problem. Now, a business story, Kathleen, when we have you there. Jameson-owned Pernod Ricard in merger talks with US group behind Jack Daniels. This is kind of interesting because it looks like two companies, one acquiring the other, but both under pressure. Their share prices down in one case 20% and the other 25%. So these are two companies that are trying to salvage a merger, I think, to improve their individual scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some analysts were saying that this is kind of the start of some inevitable consolidation within that market because it is so stressed at the moment. And it has been for quite a while. And there's lots of different kind of analysis in terms of why drinks giants are struggling so much. Some point to kind of changing in drinking behavior, some point to the kind of bigger picture. But it is just a sign of what we'll see in that industry. And as lots of people point out, they're in talks. That doesn't mean it will necessarily happen, but I think it's a sign of things to come.
I don't know if you like a slice of pizza, Larkin, but there's some good news from Bambino. They have two sites in Dublin, one around the corner from us here, another one down on Marion Street. Nice increase in profits and a nice margin on a slice of pizza.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's just a report on the accounts filed by Bambino. It's a as you mentioned, a pizza.
By the slice.
By the slice. And they made profits of almost, well over $500,000 in the 12 months to the end of April last year. So very profitable for a startup company. They're doing well. I mean, I work not too far away from the Marion Street outlet. And I remember the first day I walked past it and said, at last, New York style pizza in Dublin. How has it taken so long for this to take off? And like you go there to any day during the week now, there's queues all the time for it. It's very simple. It's a great business model. They've got a very narrow choice of menu. It's a very simple product. You go in, it's get your pizzas. And if you go, anyone who's ever been to New York, a slice pizza is such a famous part.
And they still have the margarita priced at under a fiver, which I think is smart.
Yeah.
So they're giving real value.
It's quick. It's convenient.
Yeah. Do you know what? I was sort of disappointed when I saw the numbers. I thought they'd be making three times that.
It's scale. Yeah,
looking at the sales.
Mm. Yeah.
It's but scale. There you go.
I think they need, like, you know, they've got two branches. If you can, it's a business that's inherently scalable.
Yeah, very much so.
So, like, I mean, that figure could be quite higher next time.
Kathleen, 70,000 vacant dwellings across Ireland in 2024. The measurement of this seems quite, I think, strange to me. They measure electricity consumption and they decide if it's below a particular level that the house is vacant. I would have thought somebody going around with a clipboard, you know, checking whether a house is occupied or not would have been a much more valid measurement, but maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question because you do wonder, like, if it's a second home, perhaps the electricity would be low or someone, you know, lives abroad for part of the year. But it's still quite a big figure. I mean, 70,000 vacant dwellings, and obviously the government are trying to bring the vacant dwellings back into the market with the refurbishment grant. And I think some housing people were saying that isn't factored into when we looked at housing figures in terms of what is going to be delivered in the future. So that if that is taken into account, we're actually more likely to hit government schools.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
An extension of that story, Larkin. It's a site, I don't know if you know it, but it's the old Hammond Lane Foundry. Originally, I think it was the Maguire and Patterson matchmaking factory. It's been lying idle, and it's a big sort of hollowed out piece of land down there behind the forecourts. And it's been owned by the government for 15 years. There's talk that the family law courts are going to be built there, but I understand that's some time off yet.
Yeah, I do know the site very well. I've lived in Dublin since 2010, as long as the government has nearly owned this site. I used to live in that part of the city. If anyone who knows it, Hammond Lane, it's just kind of around where the forecourts area is there, close to Smithfield. It's just a big hole in the ground.
Yeah.
A load of hoarding around it.
It's kind of a lake, depending on how much rain we get.
The photo in the Irish Independent today just shows the amount of water that's sitting in it at the minute. But like it's in a, you know, right in the centre of our city, around there where the legal area, I suppose, of the city is. And Roger Corman is, you know, he's quoted in the piece here, he's criticising this, you know, it's an act of vandalism from the state to leave this site in such poor condition for so long. And he's not wrong. I mean, we talk about regeneration and bringing into the city. Like, I mean, if you develop that into what it should be, I mean, it would help support that part of the city. But this is not like isolated. That part of the city in Dublin, like there's countless examples of it, but the Ormond Hotel building is right there as well, not too far away. Like both of those sites are right across the river from Dublin City Council's head office. They're almost looking out the windows at them and nothing has been done with them over the past 20 years. It is crazy.
Kathleen, I'm not asking you on air, do you own a dodgy box? But I'm going to ask you about your thoughts on the piece in the Examiner today that said the complicated practice of dodgy boxism. It's a great article. It's tongue-in-cheek. It's well-written. It's worth a read.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed this piece by Colin Sheridan. I mean, I recently had twin girls, and he has this point here about roll out the testimonies, give us the besieged father of four children under five pleading his case. Without his dodgy box, there is simply no way his household survives the winter. I mean, I think this is it. Like, streaming, there are too many streaming services. There's too much of everything. And so people have dodgy boxes.
Yeah.
Like, I think, you know, and he talks about how that's just almost like Irish culture that we just kind of, we've all accepted it. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how this develops, if the government is really going to crack down on it, but it would be a tough task.
It's a great piece of writing by Colin.
Isn't it?
It's well worth a read for anyone who picks up the Examiner today.
The key line for me in it was, because you can't really police something that has drifted into social acceptability.
Yeah, he's a great line. Even writing about dodgy boxes carries a faint whiff of taboo. It's a bit like saying that while you're not a communist, you can see where they're coming from with their manifesto. thinking it is fine, saying it out loud is where you get into trouble. It's very good.
Yeah, no, read that. It's in today's Examiner on page 14. Well worth a read. Now, Larkin, I don't know how you feel about the match on Thursday night, but we're seeing here, again, from the Irish Examiner, on the front page, no less, fans are selling off tickets as boys in green bow out.
Yeah, that was heartbreaking on Thursday night, the stress of that game as well. It's not surprising, I suppose. I mean, the optimism of...
It seems kind of cruel to have a kind of a loser's sort of match that means nothing even to anybody.
Even for the players and management. Yeah. I don't know how they were going to get their heads into the space for that. I mean, it's going to be tough. But look, they've given us great joy over the last few months. And maybe it will be a chance for the home crowd to kind of give them a bit of a send-off that like we'll have to wait till the next campaign to get behind them. But there's a meaningful connection between the kind of fans and the team after that last campaign. And, the players and the management all said it afterwards, like, stick behind us. So as much as people are disappointed, maybe selling tickets for the game on Tuesday night, I think there's probably people will buy them up because they want to go and show their support for them. Like we were all gutted for the team there on Thursday night.
Gatlin, there's some advice from Eilish O'Regan in today's Irish Independent that if you're feeling down after the Prague heartbreak, here's how to deal with the emotional fallout. So this is a societal thing, I think. Everybody's affected by it in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think, when you're supporting a national team and everyone was getting really behind it, as Larkin said, there's a disappointment, inevitable disappointment. And so, she says avoid doom scrolling. I think that's probably like I'm susceptible as that. Like in the aftermath, you'd want to go through and see all the reactions. It just makes everything so much worse. But hopefully, as Lorcan says, people will still show up to that game because you would hate for them to have to go play another game to a low crowd.
Yeah. All right. And then finally, I knew there was a problem with my BMI index because why BMI could mistakenly place you in the overweight category. I've always been suspicious about it. Like, all these people who are obese and you'd kind of say, well, he's not obese or she's not obese.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, it was the equivalent of a calculation on the back of a fag packet, I suppose. I've had BMI tests done before where, you can have it, it's your height divided by your weight or whatever. Or else once I remember someone got a calipers and grabbed a piece of my skin on my arm to test and it was like, oh yeah, that's 2 millimeters. So then, you need to
lose a few pounds. You're definitely obese.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's clearly not the most accurate way of measuring our weight index or our health or whatever. So, I'm not surprised to see that there's a piece in the mail, I think it is, saying that, the BMI tool is, they've looked into it and it really isn't a lot of, when they do proper investigations, most people are actually, it's not putting them in the right categories, basically, for their weight.
Last word to you, Kathleen.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I've had similar experiences with BMI. So, like, I think it impacts you as well if you consider yourself overweight. So it'd be nice to not have that impact. But I expect the weight loss companies will like it to stick around.
All right, Kathleen Gallagher from the Business Post, Larkin Allen. From Keating and Associates, thanks for joining us this morning.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. Conversation that counts.